The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Our guest, James Forman Jr., graduated from Brown University and Yale Law School, and later went on to clerk for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. After clerking, he joined the Public Defender Service in Washington, D.C., where for 6 years he represented juveniles and adults in felony and misdemeanor cases. Professor Forman loved being a public defender, but he quickly became frustrated with the lack of education and job training opportunities for his clients. So in 1977, along with David Domenici, he started the Maya Angelou Public Charter School, an alternative school for dropouts and youth who had previously been arrested. At Yale Law School, where he has taught since 2011, Professor Forman teaches constitutional law and a course called Race, Class, and Punishment. Last year, he took his teaching behind prison walls, offering a seminar called Inside Out Prison Exchange, Issues in Criminal Justice, which brought together in the same classroom 10 Yale law students and 10 men incarcerated in a Connecticut prison. Professor Forman's first book is the critically acclaimed Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America, which was nominated for both the National Book Award and the American Librarian Association's Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence. A Washington Post bestseller and a New York Times editor's choice, Locking Up Our Own has been called superb and shattering in the New York Times and eloquent and sobering in the London Review of Books. Professor Randall Kennedy of Harvard Law School, who has graced this stage many times, writes, in ongoing discussions about crime and justice in America, particularly its racial dimensions, no book will be more essential than Locking Up Our Own. Please welcome James Forman Jr. to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you very much for that wonderful introduction, and thanks everybody for coming out this evening. It's great to be here to see. I had a chance to visit with a good friend of mine, a mentor and a hero of mine, Bob Schwartz, who some of you may know. There he is. And he's been an advocate for kids in the juvenile system for many, many decades. And if you don't know about his work, I would encourage you to find out about it and to continue to support the work of the Juvenile Law Center. They're doing incredible stuff, so thank you, Bob. I thought I would start this talk by telling you a little bit about what motivated me to write this book. And my first motivation has nothing to do with the criminal system. I'm the kind of person, I don't know if anybody else here is like this, but I'm the kind of person who, if I go see a film and there are no African-American characters in the film, somebody asks me at the end, you know, what did you think about this movie? And my first reaction is always, well, you know, where were the black characters? Where was that representation? Where were those stories? Where were we represented? And I knew that when I wrote my first book that I wanted to write a book that had African-American intellectuals, politicians, civic leaders, judges, prosecutors, elected officials, activists engaged in intellectual and policy debates. I wanted African-American characters front and central in the narrative, not the best friend who, you know, gets killed at the end of the first act, but the main characters in the story. And my other motivation very much grew out of work in the criminal system. I was a public defender. And there are a lot of stories in this book. There's history, there's argument, but fundamentally it's a book of stories. And one of those stories is a young man that I represented by the name of Brandon. Brandon had pled guilty to possession of a gun and possession of a small amount of marijuana. And he was facing sentencing, Superior Court, Washington, D.C. I was the lawyer that had been appointed to represent him. And I had taken the job because I viewed it as the civil rights work of my generation. My parents met in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. My dad was the executive secretary of that organization. My mom was a member. This is one of the major civil rights groups of the 1960s. And they were an interracial couple. My dad's black, my mom's white. They were an interracial couple at a time when those marriages were illegal in many states in this country. We just had the 50th anniversary of Loving versus Virginia. And their generation, and I say their generation, but I know there's some people in the audience that are part of that generation. So if that's you, when I say their, in your case, I mean your. Right? Their and your generation changed America fundamentally. This was a generation that faced down Bull Connor's dogs and marched across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, went to D.C. 250,000 strong for the March on Washington for jobs and freedom. This was a generation whose struggles had made it possible for somebody like me to live a life that was unimaginable to a black man of my father's generation. He grew up in de jure segregated Mississippi, de facto segregated Chicago. And here his son was clerking on the Supreme Court, getting ready to take a job as a public defender. And yet, it was also clear to me graduating law school in the mid-1990s, I could see all the unfinished work of the civil rights movement, all the things that their generation had not achieved. And the place where that unfinished business kept manifesting itself in my eyes was the criminal system. We didn't have the term mass incarceration when I became a public defender. That's a term that was created in the year 2000. When I tell my students, they're like, man, you're old. You were born before we had the term mass incarceration. How is that even possible? But we did already know that 1 in 3 young black men was under criminal justice supervision. The Sentencing Project had reported that. That same report from the Sentencing Project reported that black women were the largest single growing portion of our prison system. We already knew that the United States had passed Russia and South Africa for the dishonor of having the largest prison system in the world. We had 5% of the world's population and 25% of its prisoners. All those things were true by the mid-90s. And I could see it. I could see it in my own life. I grew up in Atlanta. I grew up in a neighborhood that's kind of sort of in between working class and a middle class, mostly black, but integrated neighborhood. And 2 blocks from my house, there were 2 huge institutions growing up. Atlanta Federal Penitentiary and a GM plant. By the time I was graduating law school 20 years later, one of those buildings had closed, shuttered, and the other had built an addition. I don't even need to tell y'all which is which. So those realities and that knowledge brought me to become a public defender. It brought me to be standing next to Brandon. And I was asking for him to be put on probation. I had a letter from a football coach and a teacher at his school. It was his first arrest, attesting to his character. His mother and grandmother were with me in court. They were just this far away. They had been there for every court hearing. They wanted him to come home. The prosecutor in the case wanted him to be locked up. She was asking the judge to put him in Oak Hill. Oak Hill was D.C.'s juvenile prison. And it was a place that, well, let me just put it like this. You always left worse off than when you went in. No functioning school, no programs. Some things on paper, they would tell you, if you went down to the mayor's office, they would say, oh, we have this and that. But if you actually went into the place, the way I did, you would see that was a lie. Drugs and violence rampant. The judge that had to make the decision in the case, Judge Curtis Walker, and I should say, I changed the names of all, in the book, all the stories, that I've changed the names of the judges, the lawyers, and of my clients, and that's all to protect my clients. I'm not worried about protecting the judge, but I wanted to make sure there was no way you could ever work your way back to know who these cases were about. The judge is looking out in the courtroom, and he sees, what does he see? He sees a young black man facing sentencing. That's not unusual. If you go to Superior Court in Washington, D.C., you would think that there were no white people who lived in D.C. Or if they are, they don't commit crimes, and neither of those things is true. Black defense attorney, black prosecutor. The judge himself was African American. That's not that unusual. 40% of the judges in Superior Court in D.C. are black. And the judge is looking out, and he looks at Brandon, and he says, son, Mr. Foreman's been telling me that you've had a tough life, that you deserve a second chance. Well, let me tell you about tough. Let me tell you about Jim Crow. See, the judge had been a child in those years. He had grown up under that. And he proceeded to lecture Brandon on what that was like. And then he said, so here's the thing, son. People fought, people marched, people died for your freedom. Dr. King died for your freedom. And I tell you this, he didn't die for you to be running and gunning and thugging and carrying on and embarrassing your family and embarrassing your community with that gun, those drugs. No, he did not. That was not his dream at all. So he said, I hope you turn it around. I hope Mr. Foreman is right. But right now, today, in this courtroom, actions have consequences. Your consequence is Oak Hill. Locked him up. And I was so mad, so angry. And as I began to work through that anger, still a process, I thought about how the fact that, you know, the judge wasn't alone. I told you about the statistics of the Superior Court, but it's more than that. The city council that passed the gun laws and the drug laws that Brandon was being sentenced under, majority African-American city council. The police chief in D.C. was black. The police force was majority black, still is. The chief prosecutor in the city was none other than Eric Holder. And I started to think about, really started to wrestle with, settle into this question that my colleagues and I at the Public Defender's Office talked about all the time. But I was the one crazy enough, I guess, to decide to write a book about it. We started to wrestle with this question of how was it that over the last 40 or 50 years, starting in the 1960s to today, how was it that as the United States embarked on an experiment the likes of which the world has never seen, an experiment in locking up its own citizens, right? No country's ever tried to do this at this scale. How was it? How was it? That at least some, and in some cases many of my own community within the African American community went along for the ride, ended up thinking that some of those policies made sense. How did that happen? And I knew that if I was going to investigate that history and then try to write about it, I knew that I had to keep two things front and central. Never lose sight of them. The first is, as mad as I was at the judge that day, I couldn't research or think from a position of anger. I had to try to write from a stance of empathy and compassion and understanding. I actually had to really try to understand where people were coming from, including people that I disagreed with. The second thing that I had to do was, even as I was writing about African-American elected officials and the communities they represent, which is the heart of this book, I could never, not for one chapter, not for one page, not for one paragraph, I could not for one sentence, I could never lose sight of, and I could never let the reader lose sight of, the larger structures of institutional racism and structural racism and the larger power structures that these African-American, mostly local elected officials were embedded within. the ways in which they were limited and constrained, the ways in which they didn't have all the options on the table that they would have wanted to have. So that's what brought me to write the book. Now, we could stop here. I understand that there's books for sale. We could go out and buy copies of the book, and we could do, you know, sustained silent reading. My son is 8. In third grade, they do sustained silent reading. Everyone gets a reading and sits down for 20 minutes or as long as they can go without somebody talking. But I'm figuring since y'all came out to this book talk, you want to get like the highlights of the argument. So let me do that. The first thing that we have to understand to figure out how we got here is to understand rising crime and violence and addiction and the fear and the anger that they generated in black communities over the last 50 years. So my students tend to know a little bit about, not typically from direct experience, but maybe from media representations of crack years, 80s, early 90s. But before that, even before that, in the 60s, there was heroin. Heroin devastated black communities in the 1960s much in the same way that crack would 2 decades later. The homicide rate in this country doubled in the 1960s. It tripled in Washington, D.C. It more than doubled in Philadelphia. Heroin, they track everybody entering the D.C. jail every year. They test them for various different drugs. They concluded in 1963 that 4% of the people entering the D.C. jail were heroin addicts. 6 years later, that 4% had become 45%. By 1969, 45% were heroin addicts. Now, that's an epidemic. And it wasn't just the numbers, but it was also the response that they generated from the community. So to write this book, one of the things that I did is I went back and I looked at letters. A lot of the African-American elected officials in D.C. have donated their papers to local area libraries and in other cities as well, but mostly I looked in D.C. And those papers... they're not scanned in any database. There's no keyword searching, unfortunately. You can't put in like drugs, and you have to look at every piece of paper. But if you do that for summer after summer, what you will find is this incredible social history, because a lot of the officials kept the letters that they got from constituents. So those are all there. And their responses in some cases are there. So what you see is in a mostly black city, D.C. 70% black in the 1970s, Chocolate City, writing to mostly black elected officials, 11 out of 13 of the first city council members are African American, about problems in the city. And what you see is, over and over again, you see people saying things like, this is in the 1970s, early 1980s mostly, I don't know what's happened to us as a people, as a community. I can't go outside. Because they're selling drugs on the corner, and I'm afraid, and I don't want my kid to see that, and I can't leave them in the park after school because they're shooting in the park. It's not safe. And over again saying, do something, you got to do something about it. Now, who's receiving these letters? That's the second big argument in the book. The generation of people that is receiving these letters is the first generation of African-American officials to come into office after the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the decline of formal Jim Crow. There's an 800% increase nationally in the 1970s and early 1980s in African-American elected officials. This is a generation of people. Many of them are from the South. Some of them were in the Civil Rights Movement with my parents. All of them remember the long history of underprotection and underenforcement of the law that has marked American history. My dad used to tell me about this, and then I did the research and saw it everywhere. 1940s, 1950s, Mississippi, Chicago, we didn't call the police when there was a crime. The police weren't going to come to a black community, and if they did, I'll tell you this, they would have made matters worse. They remember Southern sheriffs in cahoots with the Klan, and not just Southern, a lot of Southern, but as y'all know, there's plenty of South in the North, in cahoots with the Klan, said homicide. When asked about homicide, black community, that's not a homicide. That's another dead black person. And trust me on this, they did not use the words black person. So they remember that history. They're formed by that history. Now they're in office, in municipal government. Now they have some control of things like the local police department. And they are bound and determined to respond to those letter writers, those people asking for protection, who wouldn't have even bothered to write 20 years earlier because they wouldn't have bothered to write before they were African-American elected officials because they knew they wouldn't be listened to. Now they expect a response, and this generation wants to deliver it. All right. There's a reason to care. Crime is rising, and addiction is a problem. They're motivated, many of them out of a racial justice and civil rights viewpoint, want to respond. But why with police and prosecutors and prisons? Why is that the response? That's the hardest question in a lot of ways, and the answer is in connected to what I said earlier when I said that I was writing about African-American elected officials, but I'm also writing about the constraints and the limitations that they were operating under. And so let me mention a couple of those. The first constraint is a historical one. This first generation of black elected officials is elected to represent and protect communities that in many ways, because of government policy over centuries, have been made unable to protect themselves effectively. So because of a history of racism, of slavery, of Jim Crow, of segregation, of redlining, where you couldn't get loans to buy or improve your house if you lived in a black neighborhood or an integrated neighborhood. Decisions like where to place federal highways in the 1950s, 1960s. I don't know the story in Philadelphia, but in a lot of cities, including in Atlanta where I grew up, they had a choice about where to put highways. They put them smack down in the middle of black neighborhoods, destroying. In Atlanta, it was Auburn Avenue, Black Wall Street, we used to call it. Before my time, they used to call it. I-75, I-85, right down through the heart of that neighborhood, destroying it. Still hasn't recovered. So in a lot of ways, the communities that I'm writing about and the elected officials that I'm writing about, you could say that they had the power to respond to crime, but they lacked the resources to respond to the underlying conditions that cause crime. Now, the second constraint is a kind of a political one. So this book is about local elected officials. That's where black political power has always been concentrated, at the city council level, at mayor's office, police chief, county council sometimes, depending on what state you live in. And one of my arguments is that local government, it matters for how we got this system and how we're going to replace it. But having said that, there are limitations to what local government can do. And you see that over and over again in the book, because what you see in this book are local black officials having what I call an all-of-the-above strategy to fighting crime and violence. They want more police and more prosecutors. But they also want more money for housing, more money for job creation, more money for mental health programs, more money for drug treatment, more money for addiction programs. They want national gun control. They're trying to pass local gun control laws in Atlanta, in Detroit, in D.C., in Chicago, in New York. But they know that what we really need is national gun control, so they're going to Congress and asking Congress to pass national gun control. They go to Congress and they say, we want a Marshall Plan for urban America. We want the United States government to do for cities, to do for black communities what it did for Europe after World War II. Rebuild, reinvest, revitalize. They go to Congress with this all-of-the-above strategy for decade after decade, and every time they come back with money for one of the above. And the one of the above that they get money for is law enforcement. As one more constraint that I want to mention. This is a constraint that feel like we still suffer from to this day, and that's constraint of imagination. There's a lot of examples of this in the book. Let me mention one. There's a guy named Dave Clark that I write about. He's a member of the first city council, Washington, D.C. He's got a very unusual biography for a white guy. He went to Howard Law School in the 1960s, and he goes on to work with Martin Luther King, becomes a lawyer for poor people. gets elected to the city council. The man is not a drug warrior. The first thing he does when he gets into office is he tries to decriminalize marijuana. 1975. Almost passes. Doesn't. That's the story of why. It's the story of chapter one of the book. Now, 5 years later, he's the chair of the city council. Heroin, which had kind of stepped back in the 70s, is raging again. And he's inundated, as our other council member was, letters saying, and I don't endorse this language, but lots of letters saying there's junkie nodding off on my stoop, they're on the corner, there's syringes in the backyard, in the alleys, D.C.'s full of alleys, and over again. You got to do something about it. Do something. So Dave Clark, he gets all these letters from citizens. He sends them to the head of the relevant government agency. He then gets a letter back. Councilmember Clark, receive your citizen complaint about attic taking up public space. We're on the case. Clark then takes all those letters and sends them back to the citizen. It's pretty good constituent services. My elected officials, like, they all I get is an auto reply at best, if I write. But who does this non-drug warrior send the letters to? Head of Department of Mental Health, Addiction Services, Department of Health, Social Worker, Public Health. No. He's not a drug warrior, but he's an American. And like so many of us, unthinkingly, reflexively, without even really asking the question, his imagination is so constrained, like so many of us, that he thinks problem of an addict in public space is a problem that requires police. So he sends his police chief. And we get police officers arresting addicts. And that's an example, just that little small example. One of the arguments of the book is that when we try to figure out how mass incarceration was built, it's tempting to look for kind of these big shiny objects, these moments, a pronouncement from the executive office, a big piece of legislation. But in fact, it's these small, tiny, unseen in many cases choices that many people have made, including in some cases good, well-meaning people like somebody like Dave Clark. Those decisions about which agency to call when you're facing a complaint about an addict, those decisions are the bricks that have helped build the prison nation that we live in today. Okay, let me spend my last few minutes talking a little bit about what we can do about this. And I want to talk about this question of imagination. Because I think we really have to push ourselves, right? We have to look back at what happened. One of the arguments that grows out of this book is that some of what we've created in this society has been a response to concerns about safety and security. In many cases, legitimate concerns. Not every instance is, you know, we have an attorney general now who fear-mongering and ginning up. There's plenty of panic mongering. But there's also a lot of folks who are really worried and really concerned about security in their neighborhoods. And what we got, what was delivered, was police and prisons. And so the question is, our challenge, it seems to me, the kind of the challenge of this moment, as more and more Americans are starting to say, well, this doesn't make sense. This is unjust. This is immoral. This should be abolished. The challenge for us is thinking about what we replace it with and what are the steps towards replacing it. So I think there's going to be set aside some time for question and answer. We can get further into this, but let me just touch on, there's a lot, we're now in a moment where there's a ton of really powerful ideas that are out there. There's, starting in Seattle, but now national program called Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, which wants to reimagine the role of police officers and say, what if that police officer, what if that Dave Clark called for, what if that police officer's job wasn't to make an arrest? But what if that police officer's job was, with the consent of the individual that they were in conversation with, to help them get directly into a treatment program, completely bypassing the criminal justice system. So the beauty of the LEAD program, and I encourage you to look at it, LEAD Bureau, LEADBureau.org. If it's not in Philadelphia, they're expanding rapidly nationally. They're cutting racial disparities dramatically in drug arrests in the cities that it's been introduced, and they're increasing the likelihood that people actually get off drugs. Much more effective and at much less human cost than arrest. And the beauty of this program is it's front-end diversion, so you never see the court system. The court's not involved. There's no judge. There's no prosecution. There's no charges hanging over you. It's directly into treatment, consensually. There's programs like Common Justice out of Brooklyn, which are asking the question, violence is a real thing, and it needs to be addressed. But right now, what we tell people who are victims of violence, what we tell them is, what we are going to do for you to remedy you, to make you whole, the only response that you get is we're going to prosecute and lock up for a long time the person that committed the act. The communities that are victimized by mass incarceration are the same communities that are victimized by violence. And every bit of sociological and other research we have shows that if you go to those communities and you tell people, as we've been doing, that the option is incarceration or nothing, people want incarceration. They do. But what Common Justice says is, what about if we try restorative justice? What about if we actually bring people that have been harmed with people that have harmed them in dialogue with the goal of restoring relationships and restoring community and actually giving people the trauma treatment on both sides? The trauma treatment, the mental health treatment, the access to services that they need. And it turns out that overwhelmingly, if you give people that set of choices, they want that over either do nothing or prison. Bail reform. If you're not involved in the movement to try to eliminate cash bail, which is just a system that just preys on poor people, please get involved in it. It's something that's happening right now in the state of Pennsylvania and in lots of states. We have a system where when you're locked up, innocent, you are legally innocent, pending trial, you have to pay a bail, a bond, which you can't afford, and you sit in jail, and people plead guilty, not because, in many cases because they are guilty or they want to plead guilty, but simply so that they can get out. Lots of states are getting rid of it. And there's a movement right now to get rid of it in Pennsylvania, and I would ask y'all to consider joining that movement. To make this happen, of course, you have to get people elected to office that want to make it happen. You are in the fortunate position here in Philadelphia right now that you actually have a moment in time where, basically unheard of in my lifetime, in the last 40 years, you didn't get to run for prosecutor and have your main line on your bio is that you were a civil rights lawyer, that you represented poor people, that you sued police for police misconduct. But you have somebody right now in Philadelphia, Larry Krasner, who has, that is his bio, and he is running for local prosecutor. And I would encourage you, you're in a moment where you can do one simple and very powerful thing to try to reduce the pain of mass incarceration, and that's to vote in this election, to tell your friends to vote. See, I'm not a judge. I'm a professor. I can come say whatever I want. I'm not politically constrained. So go learn, look in. If you don't know about Larry Krasner, learn about him. If you do know about him, go vote for him. If you don't want to vote for him and you don't like him, you're probably not at this talk, but who knows? Last thing I'm going to say, so we have time for conversation, and I have more ideas about things we can do, but Just one other idea that I'm really passionate about is education. I've been giving these talks, telling people what they should do, and a few years ago I decided, as you heard in the introduction, I decided to change my own teaching, to take a class that I normally teach at the law school and take it behind prison walls. So the same seminar that I taught to 20 law students, I now teach in the prison, 10 students who are incarcerated, 10 students from the law school. And I always tell my colleagues, don't do this for self-interested reasons. It is true that the best teaching evaluations I've ever gotten were in that seminar. And the most meaningful ones were from the incarcerated students. One of them wrote, and the program, by the way, is called Inside Out. And to the great credit of Philadelphia, it's a program that is founded in Philadelphia at Temple and is now spread nationally. Please learn more about it if you don't know about it. Inside Out Prison Exchange. 20th anniversary conference is coming up on Friday at Swarthmore College. One of the men who's incarcerated said, I like the law and policy that we learned in this class, but most of all, when I came to this class every week, I felt like, and I was treated like I was smart, like I had important things to say. Some days I even felt like I was an intellectual. I never felt that way in school before. He's 21 years old. Think about the tragedy of that. Another young man wrote, when I come to class every week for 2 hours, I kind of sort of for a minute, I can forget that I'm in prison. I don't know what impact those particular moments will have. I do know that the research shows that for every dollar we spend educating people who are incarcerated, as a society, we get $5 of benefit in terms of taxes paid when people get released, the jobs they get, not to mention what moves me, which is the moral case for treating people like human beings whose intellectual capacities deserve to be nurtured and challenged. Last thought that I'll leave you with is not a program. It's just a way of thinking about this problem, and it comes out of a conversation that I had with my dad. It was a couple years before he passed. We were watching a movie about the civil rights movement. I asked him what he thought of it. It passed our black characters test, so that was good. He said, I liked it. He said, I like that they show this history by a film. Some people don't read books. But he said, here's what I didn't like about it. I didn't like that they made it seem like everybody was in the movement. He said, it wasn't like that. We were a minority. We were just a few of us. People thought we were crazy. I would go on college campuses and try to recruit people to join the movement. He said, administrators would run me off campus. And this is at the HBCUs. Forget about the majority white institutions. He said the tactics that we use, that they now celebrate, they vilified us for those tactics at the time. People said, oh, I agree, I'm against segregation, but don't break the law to protest it. Don't occupy buildings. Don't sit in on bridges. Don't disrupt traffic. Don't have kids marching and arrested in parks. He said, Dr. King, our greatest civil rights hero, in 1966, there was a Gallup poll. Favorable or unfavorable, two-thirds of Americans had an unfavorable view of Martin Luther King. So his point was, and he said, that when you are facing an unjust system that appears insurmountable, and you're fighting to change it, slavery, Jim Crow, mass incarceration, people will tell you that change is impossible. But if you ignore them and you keep the fight going and you take risks and you take criticism and you adopt tactics that some people tell you that you shouldn't adopt, and then you win, the same people that told you that change was impossible will turn around and be like, oh, that was inevitable. I knew that was going to happen. And then they make a movie about it. So I don't know what is the idea or the group of people in this room, like what somebody in this room is going to have an idea that's beyond my imagination. Some group of people is going to come together and organize and agitate with strategies and tactics that I haven't thought of and program ideas that are better than any of the ones that I mentioned on this stage. And collectively over time, this generation, there's a lot of students in the room, or people that look like they're the age of students. You all will be part of the generation that undoes mass incarceration and replaces it with a system that creates safety and security in a real way, and that doesn't have all of these profound and profane human costs that our current system does. And when you do that, they will make a movie about you. And Bob Schwartz and I will be there in the front row with popcorn. Thank you. I did interview many people. And the thing that you just identified is something that's very hard to pin down, because it isn't a thing that I found expressed. And so it was hard for me, although I believe that's an element of the story, it was hard to show. And it also depends a little bit on when we talk about self-hate, exactly what we mean. So one thing that I don't write about that much in the book, just because the nature of it is a little bit, well, I don't know why I don't write about it, but I don't. I'll just say that. But I believe to be true, and maybe if I write another book, it'll be in there, is that we haven't, as a society, including as a black community, but not just the black community, as a society, we haven't begun to grapple with the legacy of slavery and how it has changed and impacted how all of us think about race and think about blackness. Because if you think about, like, if you just kind of dwell for a minute in what slavery really was, like the process of buying and selling and breeding and beating a people for profit on the basis of their race. And you think about the fact that, first of all, we had slavery in this country for longer than we have not. That is something we never talk about. You know, when they teach slavery in the school, it's like one unit. I mean, it might be in February, the shortest month, but if it's not, it's just 1 out of 10 units. And I get that the whole curriculum can't be slave. I wouldn't want that to be the whole curriculum, because that's not even all of our history. It's also a history of strength and resilience. But there's something wrong with the way we present it. Okay, so, and then, that's just slavery. If you add slavery and Jim Crow, we had those regimes for 3 times as long as we have not. So think about that. And then think about the lies that a society has to create for itself if it's going to justify a regime as brutal as slavery. And I don't mean in a general sense. I mean in a quite precise way. Think about the stereotypes. Think about the lies that society has told itself about black people and about blackness. And every single one of them you can trace to a justification that is needed to make a society believe that slavery is okay. Don't let black people are dumb, intelligent, don't want to learn. Laws prohibiting black people from learning, you justify them by saying they don't want to learn anyway. And it won't benefit them to learn because they're intellectually inferior. Black people have higher pain thresholds. If anybody's in the medical profession, there's a ton of research done showing that medical providers believe, anybody that we've studied believes that black people have higher thresholds for pain. Where does that come from? Slavery. The lies you would have to tell yourself as a society to explain why something as brutal as what you're doing to somebody may not be quite so brutal because they don't feel pain in the same way. Think about the lies we tell ourselves about black parents and children. Right? The child welfare system hasn't begun to get the scrutiny that it deserves, and the way in which we take black parents children from black parents, how do we justify that? They don't care about their kids in the same way. Where's that lie come from? Pulling children from their parents at auction blocks and selling them to another state. You can try to tell yourself a little bit that, well, they're not actually human being, but that lie couldn't hold up across slavery. Because people were in close proximity, they saw they were human beings, so they had to come up with these other lies like, oh, they don't love their kids in the same way. That's why doing something as utterly inhumane as taking a child away and selling it down the river can be justified. You can think of yourself as a moral person and still do that. And of course, the one that brings us here today, blacks is criminal. That lie, right? That lie you need to justify a set of laws and codes that you put in place going back to the days of slavery and in the years after slavery, where you criminalize conduct that is conduct that black people engage in. You pass loitering laws because people are trying to get off these post-emancipation plantations and they're trying to get somewhere else to work. So you pass loitering and vagrancy laws to keep them in place, to keep them working in slave conditions, and you justify those to yourselves as these people are criminal. So every single lie and stereotype that we've ever told ourselves in American society, I believe, is rooted in slavery and the need to need for people to conceive of themselves as moral people while leading an immoral regime. And here is the thing about African Americans. We are Americans. We are part of this culture. We read a lot of the same history. We've been exposed to a lot of the same lies, which is why all of the research on implicit bias and otherwise says that black people suffer from it too. Not to the same extent, to a reduced extent, but still to a significant extent. Most of the stereotypes that we have in America, including, most importantly, the stereotype of black criminality, is one that seeped into all of us. So yeah, I think that is part of the story. It was just a part that I found challenging to write. You know, the hardest thing about writing a book, there's so many hard things, but you know, one of them is figuring out what to leave out. Because I knew that I wanted to write a book that was like not much over 200 pages and definitely under 250. I wanted to write something that was accessible, that was readable, that academics would take seriously, but would have a chance of reaching a broader audience. And I felt like a 400 or 500 page book wouldn't do that. And so the real simple answer for why I kind of cite Muhammad, make reference to that, but don't focus on it, is that I wanted to make the book manageable, and he wrote that book. So I didn't have anything to say about what he wrote about that I could have said better than him. So I kind of feel like there's certain people, they get it. You know, they're like, oh, he nailed that. So let me just be like, if you're interested in that, go read Muhammad, because he said it better than I could. So I think we're talking about a lot of the same themes. He just goes much further back in time than I do. And so that's really the reason why. You know what? I'm so glad you asked that question. I love that. You know, that chapter 3 is my favorite chapter. Every author has a favorite chapter, I think, or this author does, and that's my favorite chapter. And it was part because I didn't know. It was like all this history was unknown to me. I did not know for how long civil rights leaders were demanding hiring more black officers and viewing that as a civil rights claim and hoping that hiring more black officers would change how police behaved. So Martin Luther King Sr. at Morehouse College in 1947 is giving a speech while his son is a senior. His son is a senior in college, and Martin Luther King Sr. is giving the speech. And he says in the speech, 105,000 Negroes deserve one Negro police. Atlanta's black population is 105,000, and it was, as it is now, a significant middle class and lots of people in, in a kind of positions, quasi-establishment positions, as much as they could get under the Jim Crow. And they had no black officers, and they were asking and demanding, and there were protests. I have a picture of a protester carrying that sign, 105,000 Negroes deserve one Negro police. A couple years later, they get them. There's Atlanta 8, for Atlanta's first 8 black officers. It's a massive celebration. It's in a church and black community, spills out across the street. They got to put microphones outside. Hundreds and hundreds of people have come to celebrate the hiring of these first eight black officers. And there's so many, the hopes and the expectations on them are so high. My argument in the end is that we should continue to demand hiring more black officers, but not because we think that will, because those are good jobs, that black people deserve their fair share of good jobs, but not because we think that hiring them is going to change policing. We have to do other things to change policing. I think that the thinking today, well, it's across the board. You get disagreements about this, but I think there's a lot more sophistication today, certainly among movement activists, are not fooled into that hiring more black officers is going to be the solution. They understand that changing police behavior requires reforming incentives. It requires hiring different folks, but not just on the basis of race. It requires supervision. It requires training. It requires accountability, prosecutions when people commit acts of violence, and overwhelmingly, it requires taking more and more things that we currently give police to do and say, let's take those out of the hands of the police so that we can have that function served, but with fewer officers. Right? I think there's much more sophistication today, in part because people have looked at this history. I mean, I'm not going to say that many people, everyone's read this book, An Author Can Dream, but people are aware that changing the racial composition of the police force hasn't changed police behavior in the way that the original advocates thought that it would. I agree with you that the average American doesn't know many of those things, although I think that increasingly more and more people do. I think that's why you can have somebody running for district attorney like a Larry Krasner. You can have, back in November, in the same, people don't talk about this, but a lot of Americans, this past November, for the first time in my lifetime, a whole slate of people ran for prosecutor positions. And they ran on campaigns of end money bail, of decriminalize low-level drug offenses. My predecessor opposed the death penalty. My predecessor has locked up innocent people, and I'm going to do something about that. And not all of them deserve necessarily the title of progressive, but lots of them do. And they ran for prosecutor, and they won in Alabama, in Texas, in Florida, in Chicago, in Denver, in Maryland. A guy in Texas, a career defense attorney with the words not guilty tattooed on his chest. Not tattooed on his chest. I mean, I'm hardcore defense, but I don't have that. Ran for local prosecutor and won. So I think more and more folks, you're right, not enough people know, but I think more and more folks are learning. And, as far as democracy goes, I don't know who, somebody said that thing about, well, it's, it's bad, what is it, the least bad? Yeah, it's the least bad. So I can't think of another system I'd rather have. Thank you for that question. No, that's okay. Thank you for the question and thank you for the compliment. So it's partially the reason you mentioned. So the kind of gun control that we would need that would actually be effective, in my opinion, is the kind of gun control that this current Supreme Court, and really any Supreme Court that I can imagine, would never permit as long as we have the Second Amendment to the Constitution. So it would require a constitutional amendment to have this. And given that we can't get, like, a large magazine capacity, you know, loophole that 90% of Americans support, we can't get that passed through Congress. The notion that, I'm all like, imagine the movement, and so you're like, well, that's hypocritical, because you just said, like, imagine this thing and make it happen, and my dad and the movie, and that's all right, that's true. But I just decided to pick on, other things that seem to me, while still hard, short of a constitutional amendment. And my worry, and then here's the other reason why I don't talk about it, having read the book, the second chapter does talk about gun control, but I don't talk about it as a solution going forward. And the reason for that is that I don't actually like the compromise that we've reached, which is that in some cities, D.C. is one of them, but it's not the only one. In some cities, we have local gun control ordinances, right? We have gun laws that criminalize the possession of guns. Those laws either are in effect in cities that have large African-American populations, in many cases supported by those elected officials, who again would like national gun control but can't get it, and say, well, the local is better than nothing. But I think the local is not better than nothing. I think the local is worse than nothing. Because the local laws, what the local laws do, or as you see in New York, local prosecutions that are focused in New York City of a state law, where they prosecute people for possession offenses in New York City that they don't prosecute people for in upstate New York, or the passing of the local law in Washington, D.C., no law in Maryland, no law in Virginia, what you get, in my opinion, is you get the worst of both worlds. We have a nation awash in guns because we don't have national gun control. And we have the criminalization of gun possession exclusively in the cities where black people live. So we have all the guns, and we have people going to prison for possession of guns. In my opinion, we haven't solved either problem. We haven't solved the violence problem, and we've made the mass incarceration problem worse. And this is an unpopular position with a lot of people that I talk to. But I would tell you that if you look at the racial demographics, all of the critiques that you have, that we have of the war on drugs, racial disparities in prosecution, collateral consequences for those who are convicted, all of those things apply to what we could call the war on guns, but we don't because we're liberals and we so call it gun control, but it's still black people in prison for the possession. So that's why I don't talk about gun control. All right, I'm super sorry to end on that heavy note. Y'all took me there. But come see me in the book signing line and I'll have something more cheery for you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at Free Library.